Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The UNC Charlotte shooter is sentenced. Politics as art. The legislature draws new legislative maps. Now the courts have to decide if they're legal. Dan Bishop is sworn in as a member of Congress representing North Carolina's District 9, who will fill his state Senate seat. And if you owe medic money in Mecklenburg County, look out. They're coming for you. We have details. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to talk about those stories and many more, including Ann Doss Helms, our education reporter here at WFAE. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Glenn Burke is here. He's the editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hello to you.
Good morning.
And it's the battle of the TV titans. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Hello there.
Hello.
And Jonathan Lowe's, reporter and anchor for Spectrum News. Good morning to you as well.
Great to see you, Mike.
Good to see you too. So the big story yesterday, and it broke late yesterday afternoon, is the man charged with killing two UNC Charlotte students last semester and wounding four others in a classroom shooting, pleaded guilty to his crimes on Tuesday afternoon. His name, of course, is Tristan Terrell.
I am so sorry to everybody in New York. I am way messed up. If I could go back in time and even to the very second before I went to that classroom, I would do that and back out of it. I am so sorry. I made a mistake.
Tristan Terrell evidently has autism, among other issues, and they gave him, what, two consecutive life sentences, so he's in without parole.
Right, and that was a little bit controversial. The only harsher alternative would have been the death penalty, and some victims' families thought that he deserved that, that if he killed their children, he has no reason that he should be allowed to live. But the district attorney had other views on that.
Yeah, the district attorney was concerned that since it is known that he has autism and developmental disabilities, that could be viewed by some as unconstitutional, being cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, Julie Parlier, who's Ellis Reed Parlier's mother, spoke first at this hearing when the victims' families were allowed to speak. She said his life, referring to her son, his life was ended by a selfish, cowardly, soulless waste of a human being. May you rot in hell and experience torture every day until you're dead, which may not come soon enough. And Riley Howell's mother, Natalie, talked about her son, who's generally thought to be the hero in all this because he put his own life at risk to subdue the shooter, said today the defendant will be brought down and locked away forever so he can't harm others. Today we finish what Riley started. Pretty emotional words, as one might imagine, in that courtroom. And as you said, I think it was you, Jonathan, who mentioned that Spencer Merriweather, the district attorney, said that he understood the victim's frustration with the plea, but he had to pursue an outcome, he said, that was certain, and securing a death penalty for Terrell was not certain.
I understand why it is, why they would want a different resolution to this case. Ultimately, I have to make the decision on behalf of this entire community, as well as with consultation with the victims, and I did so.
Okay, last name is Terrell, or is it first name is Terrell, or his last name is Terrell?
Last name is
last
Terrell.
Name. Tristan Terrell.
Because we have made a habit of not mentioning the shooter's names.
Absolutely.
Anymore, so that's why I'm not familiar with him. Anything left to say about that?
I just hope that the decision brings peace eventually to the families and the victims of UNC Charlotte. I think that one thing that we can all hope for is that by having this happen so quickly, so recently to the shooting, that this will bring the healing process and start that sooner than it may have if we had to go through a long trial.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's important to mention, and you kind of stated this in the beginning, Mike, that the prosecutor certainly had to consult with the victims' families before making this decision to offer the plea deal. I mean, there are laws that require they reach out and get the blessing from the victims' family. So I know that they, you know, while they don't agree with it, they certainly probably were part of the discussion.
Well, Terrell offered an apology, but he did not offer an explanation.
No, and we still don't know a motive for this whole
thing. Even his lawyer, who said, well, he has these disabilities, and he was very quick to say that autism does not make you violent, does not make you a killer. But he
can
said
be
he
an
became,
influencer.
He became obsessed with these challenges that he had not been able to pay for college, he had not been able to find a job. And I just find this whole thing heartbreaking. I mean, the idea of a young man who's lost his mother, who's just isolated and is just sitting there stewing and obsessing, but also terrifying that he spent basically the whole academic year watching videos apparently of school shootings, going and getting guns and training on them, all apparently legally. And then, you know, that what happened for the families, I don't blame the mother for wanting vengeance.
Glenn.
No, absolutely. No one can blame the family members for wanting a more harsh sentence. But we can't overlook the fact that this young man does have mental issues. Yeah. And we're seeing that not just here, but in shootings all over the country. Mental issues and guns continue to be a deadly combination in this country. And we're not dealing with either effectively.
And even if he was sentenced to death, let's keep in mind, Mecklenburg hasn't sent someone to death row in more than a decade. North Carolina hasn't executed anyone in 12 years.
We were talking about motive yesterday and the day before. Drew Pescaro, who is one of the victims that survived the shooting, he has been outspoken in the last year. Just in this whole discussion about the shooting at UNC Charlotte, he was tweeting. He didn't really say anything on camera yesterday, you know, with the sentencing that happened yesterday. But he did tweet some very thought-provoking reasons that he that could have possibly been a scenario for Tristan Terrell doing this shooting that had to do with debt and not wanting to pay that debt, and that, you know, going to prison is exactly what Tristan Terrell wanted. And so it at least got people thinking and wondering what was the motive. And one thing that Drew Pescaro, which was touching, that he said yesterday was that people must have been firing back at him on Twitter. And he said, you know, basically anybody who was not in that room doesn't get a right to tell me
said,
how to feel.
Don't tell me how to feel. Only I know how I'm supposed to feel in this situation is what he said. Okay, that ends a terrible chapter in Charlotte's history, and particularly the history of UNC Charlotte. One hopes that's the end of it. The legislature had a September 18th deadline ordered by a state court 3-judge panel to redraw legislative districts that the court ruled as being unconstitutional political gerrymanders. They made the deadline, and the chair of the Senate's redistricting committee, Republican Senator Ralph Hayes, praised the maps as a national model.
We have a good product here that represents this legislature, its body, but meets all the criteria that the court has laid out.
We asked our political reporter Steve Harrison to join us briefly for this segment of the program this morning. Are they a national model, these new maps?
So I think this is interesting because if you at a statewide level, the new maps that were approved, Republicans were happy. And by and large, a lot of Democrats in the General Assembly felt it was a pretty fair process. Nationally, there's been a little bit of pushback, you read, because the maps still give Republicans have an advantage. And I think there's other reasons for that based on kind of where Democrats live, where Republicans live, some of the rules around drawing maps. So I feel like at the local level and in North Carolina, a lot of people felt like it was a pretty good process.
Because Jane Pinsky, who's the director of the North Carolina Coalition for Lobbying and Government Reform, whose client was one of the plaintiffs in this case, Common Cause, she wasn't exactly negative about the maps, but she was more judicious with her praise.
They were maps that were drawn in public and not in secret, but I think the maps will look not incredibly dissimilar, but a little bit better.
A little bit better? Only a little bit better?
So if you're a Democrat, I think that the maps will help them pick up a few more seats, but in terms of taking the majorities in either the House or Senate, that's still going to be really hard. And I think one of the things that, again, in North Carolina and in across the country, Democrats are clustered in cities. And so the way they draw the maps, the rules, they try not to cross county lines. So you get a place like Mecklenburg County or Wake County, those Democratic votes are still going to be concentrated in those counties, and there will be still a lot of, like, quote, wasted votes, right? You'll still have these elections where the Democrats win by huge margins, and that's there's just no way around that.
Map drawers had to do this by order of the court in full view of the public. How did they accomplish that?
So there was a lot of back and forth where, you know, at one point, of course, during last week's crazy budget override vote in the House where the Republicans accused the Democrats that they were in secret making maps. But by and large, which the Democrats denied. But, yeah, they had rooms and you could watch the full process when legislators would request, like, you know, move this here, move this there. And one of the things they had to do, they did try and protect incumbents. So when legislators were double bunked, you know, two in one district, they would move pieces around to give them each a home.
It is a story-packed hour ahead here on Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE. Political gerrymanders were declared illegal by this three-judge panel, but racial gerrymanders have been long unconstitutional nationally. So how do you do this? How did they approach doing this with no bias politically and no bias racially? And did they succeed?
So what they had, the Republicans agreed to take maps drawn by a Democratic expert who testified for them in the trial, a University of Michigan professor. And they had who created, I think it was, what, 2,000 maps? And they legislative staff kind of pulled from these maps that the professor drew a handful of maps that they felt kind of hit the requirements that they were looking for. And then they brought the lottery machine. The state North Carolina education lottery machine picked maps out of the machine. And those were the starting point. One thing I think that's interesting is that if you look at Mecklenburg County, right now Democrats have 16 of the 17 House and Senate seats. The new maps are going to make it easier for the Democrats to hold those huge majorities. And if you're a Republican in Mecklenburg County, you've already been seeing kind of some talk about this. You think, wait a minute, we're in the minority, but we're still 30-35% of this county. And they're saying, how is it fair that we have one seat out of 17?
That was Dan Bishop's seat, correct?
Dan Bishop's seat, which will probably, under the new maps, become Democratic next year.
That Democratic State Senator Jeff Jackson, also from this area, said that these are the fairest maps and this was the fairest process in North Carolina in my lifetime. That's a quote from him. Yet he voted against them. Why?
He did. He said he felt it was kind of a vote on principle. He said he felt like that the politician should not be involved at all. He would like to see an independent, non-political commission draw the maps. That's how they do it in some states like California. Jeff Jackson, his case is interesting because his old district was really gerrymandered where they packed Democratic voters in. Hillary Clinton won his district by 55 percentage points. So we talked about wasted votes. That was one where there were thousands of wasted votes. His new district, it will be somewhat competitive, but it was still a district that Clinton won by 12. So he comes in with a big advantage.
So these maps passed, obviously, the legislature on their way to the courts. The courts now will rule on whether or not they think they did a good job. What's the chance that they will rule against the maps that the legislature okayed?
I don't know. That's going to be really interesting to see what how much – whether they feel like these were appropriate, these were good draws. I don't know. That's going to be fascinating to see, because it's very hard, even in a 50-50 state, to draw maps that produce a 50-50 result. I think it's a very difficult.
Yeah. We've been through this now for, it seems like, forever, these maps being redrawn and redrawn and redrawn again, and they're going to have to be redrawn yet again after the 2020 census. Does this exercise have any hope of causing the legislature to say yes to creating a nonpartisan commission to draw these maps in the future in 10 seconds or less?
I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to see.
And you are out of time. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Here we are at the final day of WFAE's fall membership campaign. More than 3,500 listeners have stepped up and given. Now, we're looking at you. It takes listener support at all levels for Charlotte Talks to keep you engaged in what's happening in this community and for WFAE to remain as strong as it is today. So call 704-549-9000 or go to WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We have a round table, well, kind of a cleverly shaped table, of reporters here with Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor from Spectrum News, Joe Bruner from WSOC-TV, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms from our newsroom at WFAE, along with Steve Harrison, who's talking about what's going on in Raleigh, because he covers that for us here at WFAE. As I said, the final decision on the maps that they finally finished drawing, the legislature finished drawing and passed on to the courts, have to be decided on by the courts. So what criteria will the courts use to decide if the legislature met their responsibilities?
So I think the big one was, were the maps created without using, of course, racial data was prohibited before, but were these maps created without using like partisan political data to go in and say this district is would be a plus four Republican or et cetera, et cetera? Did that happen? You know, I think that did happen in terms of the baseline maps that they pulled out of the lottery machine. Then the question is, when both sides went to kind of tinker with them a little bit to protect incumbents to not double bunk, did that go too far? Mm-hmm. Did it still meet the original goals?
So if approved, when do these districts go into effect?
So these would go into effect for the 2020 elections.
Okay, so next November. And, right. And if they're not approved, the courts will do it themselves, or they'll bring in somebody else to do it?
That's right.
Okay. And then again, they get redrawn again following the 2020 census.
Yes.
Stay tuned. Staying in Raleigh just for a moment longer here. Last week, we talked about this on the show last week. The State House pulled what Democrats have described as a sneaky maneuver and held an unannounced vote to override the governor's veto of the budget. Only 12 Democrats, I believe, were in the chamber last week on September the 11th because they were told there would be no vote on the morning of September the 11th. And yet House Speaker Tim Moore had said that he would hold a vote on this if he thought there wouldn't be enough Democrats to hold them back, and this was an opportunity. The Raleigh News and Observer's Paul Spreck did some fact-checking to find out where the Democrats' belief came from that there would be no vote on September the 11th. What did he uncover, Steve?
So the Democrats are saying that there was no official, it was the override was still on the calendar, it was still a possibility. Darren Jackson, the Democrat, he says he was told by David Lewis that we will not be voting. David Lewis had texted that to a reporter, so it was a bit, and then Darren Jackson then told his members that we don't need to show up. Now, there were 12 in the chamber who were there. Deb Butler, of course, who made the famous speech. John Autry, who's a Mecklenburg representative, who was there, who filmed her on his phone. I think there was only one member, right, who was at a 9/11 ceremony.
Yeah, a big part of that fact check was finding out whether Democrats missed this vote because they were at a 9/11 ceremony, and that
is what they have been asserting.
That's
correct?
What the narrative from the national media has been, that the Democrats were not there because they were at this ceremony. But the fact check found, I think, only one member was at a ceremony, and I think Governor Roy Cooper was at one as well. The rest of
where were they?
That's a good question.
Why weren't they there?
They got caught sleeping on this one.
Okay, So this still has to go through the Senate, but just because the House overrides the veto doesn't mean that it's overridden. What's the likelihood of it being overridden in the Senate, particularly after the brouhaha that came from this?
Well, the votes aren't there yet.
Okay. As we all know, Republican State Senator Dan Bishop won the special election in the 9th Congressional District here in North Carolina, and this week he was sworn in on Capitol Hill.
It is an overwhelming experience. I look forward to getting to know you all and to working together with you to make common sense solutions to make the lives of Americans better.
The 3rd District's Greg Murphy, of course, was also sworn in this week in Washington after winning a special election in that district. Dan Bishop filled the 9th District seat 315 days after the midterm election, and now his state Senate seat is vacant. Who is likely to take that seat, and how will that happen?
So the NCGOP, in conjunction with the Mecklenburg County Republican Party will appoint the member to his seat. I think some names to watch are Matthew Reinauer, Rob Bryan, Andy Doolin, Bill Brawley, and I would even toss in Victoria Nwasike, who ran against Ed Driggs. I'd throw her name in there as well. What I'm wondering is if they look at that new district that has been created, they see that it is a more competitive seat and it's not a safe red seat. If they appoint someone like a Matthew Reinauer, who has a lot of respect from Democrats, who might be competitive running
now,
for
you mentioned, Mike, you said there's a lot of names, right? And there are, because Republicans have lost a lot of elections recently. And so there are a lot of politicians who are on the sidelines now who don't have a job.
So is it the law that the Republicans nominate somebody and the governor rubber stamps it?
I mean,
because it's a Republican seat?
Yeah, they will. Yeah, it'll technically his decision, but
technically it's the governor's decision. So he could if he wants to make enemies, he could name a Democrat.
I don't think Governor Cooper thinks that he needs more enemies at this point.
Steve, thank you for being here this morning. I appreciate
thank you.
It. Steve Harrison is going to change chairs now and bring Ann Dawes Helms back into the conversation. We need more chairs. We need to raise money for more chairs. All right. News broke this week that Mecklenburg County would be taking a tougher stance on people who have overdue bills for their use of Medic. That's the ambulance service in Charlotte, Mecklenburg Emergency Medical Services Agency. What are they now planning to do to collect on those overdue bills, Jonathan?
Send it to the tax collector, simply put.
Why the tax collector?
They have the ability to levy the fine ability. Or excuse me, apparently, from what I was told, that the tax collector can levy that fine. And, you know, that you liken that to a delinquent tax bill that, you know, that can be put in the newspaper.
So they'll be able to garnish your wages because the tax people can do that, right?
Absolutely.
This is going to start on October the 1st, which is right around the corner. Outstanding claims older than 120 days from the date of service will go now to the office of the tax collector. How many people are in arrears? This is ambulance service. How many?
There are several thousand people who are in arrears.
Because
if we're talking about
the amount owed in total is $28.7 million.
Yes, if we're talking about people who are 120 days or more, we're talking about 2,678 people, according to the Charlotte Observer. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about total people who are past due, that number is higher.
It's
35,177.
Yikes.
And I think the concern is that these are often very poor people because ambulance bills are huge. You know, when my husband needed to go to an ER, I got in our car and drove him there because I didn't want to pay that. But if you don't have a car, what are you going to do?
That's covered by insurance? If you have insurance, that will pick up Medic?
A lot of times I don't think it is picked up by insurance.
People know that. People see these ambulances on the street all the time.
No.
Do you get charged if you have a car? You know, the first responders.
That's why they ask you, do you want us to take you?
Why they ask.
Right.
Do you think people know what it costs to take an ambulance?
I think people are starting to realize it because, unfortunately, people are calling Ubers and Lyfts now to go to the hospital.
What does that say about the United States of America?
And it's not cheap. I think the base for ambulance transport is like $400.
Well, the average bill here is $821, which is astounding to me. Is this another example of the lack of transparency within healthcare that people it's hard to find out what things cost in the medical world? They don't think that this is they look at this, I think many people look at it as a free service. I would never have thought you had to pay for the ambulance. My God, it's an emergency. And in the case of an emergency, who has time to shop?
Well, that's the point. Or to think, can I afford to be like, you're literally, you know, how serious is this emergency? And is this something that I can wait and take my own car, or do I need? Can I afford it and you know take the transport?
Does the Uber driver want you in his car if you are really in a bad way? I mean, is that something you want to put on an Uber or a Lyft driver or a taxi driver or your next door neighbor or your wife or your husband? Is that really what you want?
I think that's assuming that person is trained in emergency medicine. It's a gamble.
And you think this may be, your child may be bleeding, somebody may be throwing up, you know, you may be having heart palpitations, all these things. Nobody makes great decisions when they're under that kind of stress. So the idea that, you know, you should ask what the bill is going to be and weigh your options, call Uber, call Lyft. It's just, that doesn't work.
Your Uber driver doesn't have a siren and is not able to go through traffic lights.
And this is a very necessary service. People do go in their private cars. They do take Uber, which are not smart things because, as you point out, they don't have sirens. They can't go through traffic lights. They don't have trained medical people in there with you in case something goes south on the way to the hospital. But there is just not the transparency that there needs to be.
And you have no choice. You have
You have a choice.
You have medics. You have not for emergency personnel on duty in the vehicle.
Right. You have a choice not to take it.
Yeah. And you know, it's important to point out though that, you know, ambulatory service is expensive. The training that, you know, the person that's responding has received, all of the maintenance that goes into those trucks. So it goes back to what you mentioned and your insurance and what is covered, what's not covered. And a lot of times people don't know that ambulatory transport is not covered.
If you're indigent or you're not wealthy and you have hospital costs that you cannot afford to pay for, they find a way around that many times in hospital settings. Do they find a way around that in this situation with Medic?
That is my understanding, that in hardship cases, they do make provisions. I don't know how those provisions work. In some cases, they can alleviate the expense altogether.
Why this change in stance now? Why suddenly we're sending these bills to the tax collector and they're going to be collected one way or the other? Why now?
That's a good question. This appeared to just come from nowhere.
Yeah, it's the first I've heard of it.
There had been no discussion. We do know that, as it's been pointed out, these are expensive services. Taxpayers do pay, I think, about $11 million out of the $66 million budget for Medic. And what we're hearing is that they're trying to keep those taxpayer charges from going up.
It's my understanding they used to send the bills to a private agency. Now they're sending them to the tax collector. And the reason they're doing this is because the system has got so bloated.
Okay. And also the tax collector can garnish your wages in a private agency.
Absolutely.
I guess cannot. Of course, they could put a quarter cent sales tax and pay for all of this. Speaking of which, we're nearing the end of September, and we have just weeks from now. We'll have an election in November, and they're planning to have still on the ballot a referendum to raise sales taxes by a quarter cent. Although it will ostensibly be to support the arts, parks, and greenways, the wording on the ballot by law cannot reflect that promise. And both those for and against this move are scrambling to get voters' attention now. Who's leading the fight on both sides?
It's hard to tell who's leading the fight. Both sides geared up in earnest last week. The pro-tax group, known as the Partnership for Better Mecklenburg, it included arts organizations, educational organizations, parks, arts and culture. They launched their campaign at the Carol Hefner Center last Friday, a week ago today. And they had performers, they had speakers, and the next day there was a debate at the St. Luke Missionary Baptist Church where both sides kind of came together to state their case.
Well, and you mentioned arts, parks, and greenways, but also education is in there. Pretty much everything except puppies that people like. You know, so, and I think that
puppies are in the park.
There you go. But I've heard people say, I support the arts, I support education, I support all of this. I have concerns about approving a new revenue stream that is not locked into anything. And I could see this becoming something like the education lottery, where people say, look, we just approved this thing. Why are teachers not making $60,000 a year? Why do you not have everything you need for education?
This was the idea, I believe. This goes back a ways, and I'm a little foggy, of the Arts and Science Council, because their funding model was broken with the Great Recession and has never returned. We used to have the most successful arts fund drive in the country, and now not so much. So the people in favor of this see this as a way to fix that, but have they settled on how the money is going to be collected? That seems to be one of the sticking points.
It's been the long outstanding question since this was pitched last year. Being able to give people a line by line of where this money, I mean, initially, I think it was said it was going to raise like $50 million, and $20 million of that would go to arts and sciences, and the rest county commission could figure out how to divvy up. We still don't have answers on that, Mike, as to what that breakdown is going to look like. So, you know, voters are very aware of that, and it has not been made clear to people how that money is going to be spent, where it's going to go.
And that's something they have to figure out soon. Absentee ballots are going out very close to today. So they have to get this question answered, or people are going to start voting. A couple weeks ago, Trevor Fuller mentioned that he had concerns about who has the final say over the money. He thinks the county should have that final say, and the county is proposing that they just give the money to Arts and Science Council.
It's the local news roundup on WFAE and WFHE. What are those against this referendum saying?
Well, one of the things, Matthew Ridenour, who represented the groups opposed to the referendum, one of the things he pointed out was that although we have broad categories for how the money would be spent, there is nothing that would obligate future county commissions to abide by that. Somewhere down the road, they could change and put in totally new line items for this money.
And another thread that's been running through this is, are the arts a luxury? You know, are we charging a sales tax that will be somewhat regressive for, you know, people who go to the opera or spend a couple hundred dollars for a ticket to a play? But they've countered with part of what the Arts and Science Council can do is make sure that lots more people, young people, people without a lot of money, get access to the arts, and the arts should be for everybody.
Well, and I mentioned this point because we've talked about this a couple times, Mike, that the overarching theme is arts, but this money will also go to recreation centers across the city, the parks part of this, recreation centers that need expansion, remodeling. They're, you know, serving so many kids that they need more space. So, you know, I think that hasn't been sold enough just outside of the arts. Where will this money go to?
And remind us again why they can't put this on the ballot to put the promise that here's the vote. We want you to vote on whether or not you want to raise sales taxes, and it's going to go here. They're not allowed to put that on the ballot.
It's
why
state law.
Not?
It's state law. Law. It's silly.
Well, according to Ridenour, it could not be put that way because there is nothing obligating the county to spend it that way. So,
well, we talked about this before, but I keep forgetting because I'm not bright. Why we can say we can't touch the money we collect in taxes for the hotel motel tax? It has to go to things like that are related to that. We can't move the money around, but we can move this money around. Why?
Apparently so.
Well, that too is state law.
Okay. One of the concerns is a board that's in office now making obligations for our future boards.
Okay. We'll have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about more criticism coming in for Sheriff Gary McFadden and also all a bunch of news revolving around public schools. That's why you're here, Anne. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We have assembled our reporters here at the table. Andos Helms from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden came in for another round of criticism from the Trump administration for his approval, or his refusal, rather, to cooperate with ICE. Ken Cuccinelli, who is the acting director of United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, was in town to dedicate a new 31,000-square-foot immigration office here, and he told the media McFadden is, quote, literally releasing child rapists and sexual abusers. This is unbelievable. Attempted murder, he said. I'm just going back a year or two. This is not the 80s. This is last year. This is 2019. Well, a year or two, McFadden wasn't the sheriff, and the sheriff at the time was cooperating with ICE, so obviously that's inaccurate. What about this claim that McFadden is releasing child rapists and sexual abusers? What's the foundation for that?
We have one person, I believe, who was cited who had done some of those things, had been charged with those things, and was released. And I don't have that in front of me.
And
I don't
why was he released?
Because bond was set. Yeah. And when bond is set, the sheriff, he would argue, has to abide by that and release the person.
And when that person was released, is it not true that ICE had him arrested?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
What's the problem?
It's become a political scoring point.
Isn't it also the magistrate who decides about bond rather than the sheriff? The sheriff just decides that that bond having been set, he's not going to dial ICE and say, come on over and get this guy.
Correct. They accuse him of breaking the law, but or not following the law, and he is absolutely, according to him, following the law.
Him being Gary McFadden.
Correct.
On the other hand, McFadden has said that, quote, as a former attorney general, the acting director is aware that I have the discretion to not honor a voluntary agreement, which is not a failure to cooperate with another law enforcement agency to enforce the law. Is he splitting hairs?
McFadden's argument is it's voluntary. You know, you can ask me to hold this
and I can say
guy
no.
And I can say no. I think what ICE is saying, though, is they would like a call letting them know that this man or woman was just released onto the streets.
But then ICE did not give the sheriff a call when a known felon had been in the county for a long time. This is all political.
It is.
And it could be resolved very easily if both sides really came together and worked together to keep people who are dangerous in jail and not set bail for them. And that way, it would not be up to the sheriff to let that person go.
And when you have an extreme like this, it seems really clear that, of course, these guys shouldn't be out on the street. But a lot of the people who are arrested and who turn out not to be properly documented have been accused, not convicted, but accused of really some fairly minor issues. And that's where the sheriff is saying, if that becomes, you know, if we become the enforcement arm of ICE, people who are immigrants or who have family members who are immigrants are just going to steer clear of us.
So we're going to switch gears to education because we talked a lot about this last year, and I think it was last year, time runs together, about Matthews wanting to break away from Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and they got a bill passed in the legislature that allows them, it is Matthews.
Well, it started with Matthews, and it became four towns.
Oh, I see. It was Matthews, Cornelius, Huntersville, and Davidson.
Not Davidson. I think Mint Hill.
Mint Hill. All right. Well, Davidson also, I think, declined the opportunity
Correct.
Or something to be part of that. So this week, Cornelius took a look at this, evidently. The Cornelius Downtown Board heard findings from a committee formed last year to explore options there, educational options. What did the committee report back?
That they couldn't figure anything out. Some of the options included splitting from CMS or creating these municipal charter schools that were authorized as part of this controversial bill. And that just became a huge statewide thing. No one has actually actively pursued these municipal charters at this point. And the Cornelius Task Force said, you know, it sounds like a good idea, but splitting is difficult. And if we spend our money and create a charter school here in Cornelius, then our beloved public schools, we can't just pull 20% out and have more room. They're going to bring in more kids.
We should point out that charter schools already exist, but this bill would allow the towns to own and operate their own charter schools.
And give seating preference to municipal residents.
And Huntersville, just to remind folks, did this same exact thing with a commission that studied options, and they came up with the conclusion of they would like to split off, but they realized that it wouldn't be feasible.
So this committee was set up to study multiple options, one of which was breaking away from CMS and starting their own charter school system, and committee chair Jack Higgins painted a gloomy picture of that last option.
I think it'd be extremely, extremely hard to pull that off. It's a political hot potato. I do not see that happening with the present legislature.
So what other options did they explore?
They explored working with Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, and I think that's what they're doing more or less. There's still some tension there. It's not as extreme as it was. It may flare up again when we start doing bonds or student assignment again. Those are the real hot points.
Okay, so he was talking about breaking away from CMS altogether in that clip that we just played. But in May, a committee in Huntersville recommended that they form their own school district. So why does Huntersville feel they can do it, and Cornelius, which is right next door, feel that they cannot?
Well, it's a very complicated thing, and at least since the 90s, the suburbs, when they get frustrated with CMS, have said, we need our own school district, and it has never become a proposal. It's always become a sentiment, so I think it would be fascinating if Huntersville drew up a plan to say it would work this way, here's what we're asking the legislature to do, here's how we would finance it, here's how we would deal with the county-owned buildings that are within our city limits, because I'm not sure if you're not part of CMS that you can still use those buildings for free.
So meanwhile, CMS has moved schools who pushed for HB 514. That was that legislation we were talking about. The areas that pushed for that to pass, Matthews, Midhill, Cornelius, and Huntersville, they pushed those schools to the back of the line when it comes to new facilities and improvements in construction. What's the thought process there, that if you're wanting to break away, we're not going to put any money into you now for a while?
Yeah, they were essentially saying, if you have this capability and you could build a charter school right next to, say, we say we're going to build a new CMS school right here, you whip out a charter school in a big box office next door, we've wasted our money on that school. So they kind of pushed really hard on that, and I think it certainly got attention. The school board has now kind of soft-walked it. Oh, we weren't really threatening, but it's there. It's on the books. And some people are saying, if you're really serious about working together, take that off. Their next meeting, they have the Municipal Education Advisory Committee, MEAC, which is a horrible name. But their next meeting will be to look at how CMS decides where to build and renovate schools. And that's going to be a hot topic, because that will have to say, how are we said we're going to put you at the end of the line. None of you have renounced your municipal charter powers. Here's how it works.
Okay. New CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston last week named his new cabinet. I didn't know that the schools had a cabinet, but okay.
That's kind of an informal term.
He elevated a couple of experienced staffers, reassigned five top administrators, including former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox as chief of staff. Who are involved in all of these moves?
Well, the biggest striking thing is how many of these are longtime CMS veterans who are well-known to people, and I think that sends a huge signal. I think CMS employees, principals, teachers, families are just getting weary of this cycle where they bring in somebody from the outside and that person says, let me tell you what I'm going to do. And kind of by the time they can do it, they're gone again. So these are people who are not going to come in and say, oh my gosh, you know, let's look at this entirely fresh. The deputy for academics, which is, I think, the crucial position, is Matt Hayes. He is a Charlotte native. He started his career as a teacher. He's been principal at Olympic and North Mech. He knows the turf.
So Laura Francisco was brought in by Clayton Wilcox to be his chief of staff, and there was controversy at the time that she was brought in at the salary that she was being paid to be the chief of staff. Will she keep that salary in her new position, and will the new chief of staff get her old salary? How's that going to work?
The new chief of staff is Latarja Henry, who is, again, a long time. I remember her giving me the Welcome to CMS tour in 2002. She did get about a $40,000 raise to match Laura Francisco's salary. I believe Laura Francisco does not have a new contract, and most of their contracts say we can reassign you at will, but we can't change your salary. Mm-hmm. So I believe she still has the same salary.
There's also a little controversy this September over heat in school buses. It's been hot until today.
Yeah.
Are the school buses air-conditioned or they're not air-conditioned?
They are, but apparently a fair number of their air conditioners are broken. That was Elsa Gillis of WSOC reported that there are, I think, 120 school buses out of, they have about 1,100 on the road, 1,300 total fleet, and they don't pull a school bus off the road when the air conditioner breaks. So today, that'd be lovely. These last few, the first month of school, it's been miserable.
Because they're talking about some of the temperatures in these buses getting up to 100 degrees or more, particularly in the afternoon, because it's hot in the afternoon. It's not 99 degrees, 95 degrees outside.
And that bus is sitting out on a lot all day.
Why aren't they fixing the air conditioning?
Well, I think they are, but not terribly fast. And one of the questions that I think was not answered in that story, and I haven't dived into this, is do they have the mechanics they need? They've said they're doing a much better job of getting bus drivers, but bus mechanics have been a challenge as well.
And schools are also now involved in Eastland Mall.
Yes.
So, Eastland Mall news comes every once in a while. Charlotte City Council voted 8-3 this week to approve a movement school to occupy the old Harris Teeter site, adjacent to the mall. It's a piece of property not owned by the city, so why was the city involved in rezoning it?
Movement owns the building. They needed to rezone that building so that it could not be a grocery store and it could be a charter school with a religious component. Forest Hill will be using this building for services.
But the school itself will not have a religious component.
Correct.
Charter schools
cannot. It's a public charter school that will be used.
School will be secular.
Yes.
And CMS schools do that as well.
Correct.
Space.
Correct. And the blowback from the community really came at the 11th hour, and that kind of hamstringed a lot of city council members who were hearing this criticism at the last minute, and they didn't really have a lot of time to vote no against this.
The councilman actually that represents East Lamar District, Matthew Newton, voted against this.
So did Dimple Ashmira voted no.
Yes.
And that's why?
From Dimple Ashmira's perspective, she would like to see Eastland as an economic driver, Baxter Village, a Birkdale, that type of development. Her concerns were having another school at this site would hamstring future development.
Well, and again, we just talked about side-by-side schools. CMS just last year, I believe, opened a brand new K-8 school at the Eastland Mall site, Charlotte East Language Academy, and they're still working to fill that. So now they may have competition next door.
The city council was busy this week with rezoning issues because they one of the things they rezoned was the Van Landing estate, which has been in process for years now. That's something that the previous owner was unable to achieve, this rezoning, or the kind of zoning that he wanted at least. What got approved there?
Two commercial buildings will be heading to the site. I'm not sure what the commercial buildings will be used for, but the Van Landingham estate will be saved and renovated. Hopefully will be used as an event center.
And other rezoning projects include 200 senior residents and 41 townhomes on a 20-acre site on Providence Road. Julie Iselt voted no on that. Why?
If you've ever been on Providence Road, you have an idea of what traffic is like down there.
Well, plus another 56 residences split between an apartment building and six townhouses on a site just under 2 acres on Waverly and Kenilworth, just south of Romney Road, which is near Atrium Hospital. And another 28-unit development in the Belmont neighborhood was approved. Add all these together, and what you discover is a theme. Higher density. Where are all the cars going to go? I'm going to harp on this until I die. Where are all the cars going to go?
Absolutely wonderful question. You know, with the one that they approved over in Dilworth on Waverly, Councilman Larkin Eggleston says there were a lot of concerns about that because of the density, and they just put in this really huge apartment complex over there. He says that they addressed the concerns that with the frontages and how close it is to the street. But you know, back to your point, the traffic in Dilworth, for instance, is horrible.
Well, I'll let you end on that note. it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. There's also traffic problems on North Tryon Street now. There are evidently people – there's a new traffic pattern there, right, Joe?
Yeah. This was a botched launch by the city of Charlotte. It was just like everybody woke up one day and this new traffic pattern was put in place for tens of thousands of drivers. Basically, if you're heading outbound from uptown, you have to use North Tryon as a one-way street. If you're heading inbound, you use North Church Street. But for some reason, drivers could not figure this out.
So very quickly, the Hawthorne Street Bridge on Independence has been up. Pain in the you-know-what for people who live in the Elizabeth area. They stopped construction for a while. This week they started construction. When's it going to be done?
April 2020, if everything goes to plan.
What, not in time for the convention? Well, you will be in time.
in time for the convention, yes.
Baby.
All right. In football, the shoulder bone is connected to the foot bone. That's a rule of football. At least it appears to be the case with Cam Newton. He suffered a foot injury in the preseason. He's had a lackluster start to this season. He's 0-2, or we're 0-2. And now head coach Ron Rivera says Newton is questionable for Sunday's game.
It is what it is, you know. And I just want to, you know, just look at it and say, you know, the truth of the matter is, guys, we make the best out of it. We can't control the situation. We most certainly go out and do what we can't control, and that's us. So we'll take it one game at a time. We'll play it one game at a time, and we'll play with the guys that we have.
And that is all that reporters want to know from Ron Rivera. What about Cam? What about Cam? What about Cam? And yesterday, Ron Rivera had just about enough.
I'm not going to talk about it anymore, guys. I mean, let's talk about Arizona. I mean, I haven't really talked about Arizona, you know, so it'd be good to answer those kind of questions.
Cam, though.
I know it's about Cam, but that's, you know, we won't. I don't know any more until tomorrow. So let's just, you know, let's talk about Arizona. If not, there's no reason for me to stand here.
You felt before the opener, you were 100% confident he was going to be ready to go. Where are you on that level now?
I just asked you to ask me questions about somebody else. I'm not going to do this anymore, okay? I told you, I won't know anything until tomorrow. Okay? Thank you.
Golly is the last thing he says. He's walking out of the room as he does that. So, are we going to win this weekend?
Let's go Panthers. Like Kyle Allen time.
Cam. Get him on the phone. Find out if Cam will play this weekend. Would you play? Jonathan Lowe, Glenn Birkins, and Andos Helms. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.